You left one bit, brother. This is the word of the Lord. I live in Melbourne, and occasionally I ride the trams in Melbourne. If you've been to the world's most livable city, then you'll know there's a free tram zone in the inner city of Melbourne. And I ride the free tram sometime. My problem is I own an apartment just one stop outside the free tram zone. Just one stop. But hey, it's just one stop. And you almost never see a tram inspector on those trams. Almost never. So the odds of getting caught are really pretty small. But if you can cheat the system on the trams, that's nothing like cheating Coles and Woolies at the automatic checkout. It's a virtual guarantee to get away with it. Let me tell you how. Let me tell you what you do. You get mangoes, which are very expensive, and you just press carrots, which are a quarter of the price, and you walk away with your mangoes for the price of a carrot. So easy. And it's done all the time. They did a private poll of 50 university students, and 38 admitted to stealing from Coles or Woolies. That's three quarters admit to being thieves. I suspect the number might be higher, and I think people are no different from uni students. The average loss every year for these supermarkets in stealing is $7.5 billion. But I want to say, I do tap on and I do tap off, even if it's just one stop. And I call a mango at Coles. Not because I was taught, as I was, that honesty is the best policy, but because I believe in God. A God who sees and a God who judges. But I wonder what I'd do if I didn't believe in a God who sees and judges. I suspect that I would do what is right in my own eyes, as many people do. Well, we move to these last chapters of Judges. I could talk about Jephthah this afternoon, or Deborah, or Ehud and the fat King Eglon, and just leave these chapters alone, as I did for many years while preaching through Judges. I ended at chapter 16. But I can't, because these are part of God's word. Of course, calling a mango a carrot is nothing compared to what we read about in these chapters. Whenever I prepared this talk, I've always reworked my sermon on these chapters just to be careful in what I say. And it's not so hard today with a hall full of men. It's much harder with a hall full of men and women. I just saw a brother here grimace, I think, as I stood up, and rightly so. But with women there who hear this, and we are today, rightly so, I think, particularly sensitive to things like domestic violence. We live in the days of Me Too, are very aware of abuse, and I'm aware when I speak on this topic, these chapters with women there. I did this a year or two ago in another Prezi church. I talked about, as I will briefly later on, about domestic violence, knowing full well there'll be women there, and not a few, who are victims of that. We finished the talk and the session, and a woman walked right up to me, and her first words were, "I am one of those." An abused woman. The Bible describes the world as it is in all its glory and its horror, and no more so than the book of Judges and the mistreatment of women. A foolish vow by Jephthah causes almost certainly the death of his daughter. We saw last time that we saw Samson's wife-to-be burnt alive. And now in these awful stories here, the abuse of women again, and God is hardly mentioned in these chapters. One or two slight references, but hardly mentioned. But he's there, as in all the book, behind the scenes, working out his purposes. So I'm not going to apologize for speaking on these chapters. We don't know who wrote Judges, but we do. All scripture is God-breathed, every verse, and is profitable for us to read, and our wives and daughters and mothers, for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness, that we might be equipped for every good work. So we need to sit and listen to these words humbly and be nourished in the end, be nourished spiritually by them for all their horror and brutality. Well, just again, a quick overview. They're different from the previous 16 chapters. For one thing, there's no judges in these chapters and no external threat. All the danger now is completely from within, the tribes of Israel. And we see here in these chapters two incidents and two kinds of threats. One spiritual, the other moral, though the two, of course, are connected. Get God wrong, you'll get your behavior wrong. The two incidents. And both involve Levites. Not the same Levite, I think two different men, but both men from the tribe of Levi. We saw this in the Bible Project overview at the beginning. It begins in chapter 17 and 18 with a man called Micah at home with his mother from the tribe of Ephraim. And she's upset because someone, a thief, has stolen 1,100 pieces of silver from her. It's a wealthy family. Micah's a son. He fesses up that he's the thief and repays the money. And she says she was upset because she had given the money to God to make an idol of cast metal. We're in verse 3, and here are the catalogue of sins already. Don't make to yourself any graven image. Honor your father and mother. Don't steal. Not a promising start. Well, Mum makes the idol from some of the money. It ends up in Micah's house. He dresses up as a priest. He wears an ephod, makes his sons a priest. God had ordained the priests, and they were not from Ephraim, they were Levites. But he makes himself a priest, because there's no king in Israel. You do what's right in your own eyes. Well, now the Levite comes into the story. He's from Bethlehem. He's passing through Ephraim, meets Micah, who offers him a job as a priest. So they're both happy. He has a fair dinkum priest, and the Levite has a job. They're both happy. But it doesn't last for long. The scene now shifts to the tribe of Dan. That's Samson's tribe. They're still looking for a land to settle in. Like Joshua, they send out spies. There's five men to find a place for them to live. The men end up at Micah's house. They see he has a priest. They ask the priest to give them the Lord's guidance. Will they have success on their journey? He says, yes, you will. They go on. They found a town called Laish. It's a small town. People there live quietly and securely. They have no enemies, no near neighbors. In short, they're vulnerable and they're easy pickings. So the five spies race back to the tribe of Dan. They gather all their family together and head off to take Laish with 600 soldiers to guard them. On the way, they come back to Micah's house. The five spies come back to Micah's door. In the back are the 600 soldiers, and they offer Micah's priest a job. Why be a priest in a household when you could be a priest to a whole tribe? Why be a pastor when you could be a bishop? Why run a church you could run a whole denomination? Why live in a small house in the back of nowhere when you could live in Melbourne? And the offer is too good to refuse. So he takes Micah's idols with him and joins the Danites. He steals Micah's idols. Don't feel too bad for him, because when you steal from a thief, there's a kind of justice there. Well, Micah wakes up one day to find his priest is gone. He takes after the Danites, to confront them, but he's one against 600. So they persuade him, I think fairly easily, write it off as a loss and go back home. And he does. The Danites come to Laish, attack the city, slaughter the people, and set up the Levite and his idols in the middle of the city. That's scene one. And the point is this, I think. You could repeat that scene 1,000 times over in Israel back then. That's just typical of what happens. People are all confused spiritually and worship idols. They talk about the Lord, but remain really, to all intents and purposes, pagan. I watched a YouTube about 2 weeks ago by a guy called Tim Challis. Not sure if you've heard of Tim Challis. He does YouTubes. This one was on what he thinks are the 10 most influential sermons preached in America in the last 25 years. There's one there by, I think, by John Piper, maybe Tim Keller. But the last of the 10 was a sermon by a man called Joel Osteen. He is the pastor of the largest church in America, Lakewood Church, maybe 30,000 people. He chose the sermon not because it was a good sermon, but in fact a very bad one, but because of the influence. The sermon was called The Power of I Am. It became a million-selling book and became famous because this was the sermon that Oprah Winfrey said changed her life. It goes for 27 minutes. He says these two words, I am, will determine what kind of life you live. Every day, daily affirm to yourself by saying, I am. I am blessed. I am victorious. I am wealthy. I am talented. I am wonderful. I am victorious. I am qualified. I am prosperous. And when you say these things, those words I am become a magnet for these things. If you say I am blessed, it attracts to you blessings, and you're blessed. If you say I am prosperous, you attract to yourself prosperity. It's baptized paganism. There's a book some years before written by a woman called Rhonda Byrne, not a Christian, called The Secret. Again, a number one bestseller. She says you can gain anything you want in life, wealth, health, the perfect partner, business success, respect, by literally anything. The secret is the law of attraction. Think about wealth, you'll get wealth. Think about a new car, you'll get a new car. Think about a parking spot, you'll get a parking spot. She thought about her perfect weight, 116 pounds. Ever since then, her weight hasn't moved 1 ounce from 116 pounds. Think about it, it comes to you. Joel Osteen says, say I am 116 pounds, you'll be 116 pounds. Byrne writes, thoughts are magnetic, and thoughts have a frequency. As you think, those thoughts are sent out into the universe, and they magnetically attract all like things that are on the same frequency. Everything sent out returns to the source, and that source is you. I've no idea what that gobbledygook means. But like Osteen's sermon, it's just narcissism. Whatever you want, think about, affirm, and it's yours. It's baptized paganism. He's America's most successful pastor. And by the way, the sermon made no mention of Jesus. Not once. Well, that's the first incident. The second is the one we just heard about. Again, a Levite. Lives in Ephraim. Acquires a concubine. It sounds like almost a business transaction. He gives her rent and board. She gives him her body. It's the deal. She's unfaithful. We don't know what that means. It may be sexually. We're not quite sure. She leaves him. And he heads off 4 months later to bring her back. Ends up at her dad's house. Again and again, not sure why, he asks the man to stay. He finally says no, and he heads back home to Bethlehem. They stop in a town called Gibeah in the land of the Benjamites. Now, if you know the story in Genesis 18 of Sodom and Gomorrah, it's just like this one. The angels come to Sodom and spend the night in the city square, and Lot takes them in. Except this isn't Sodom. This is a Jewish city. These aren't pagans. These are God's saved covenant people. Well, the old man persuades the Levite and his family and his concubine not to sleep in the square, to stay in the house. Then these men surround the house, these worthless fellows they're called, or perverted men, literally the sons of Belial. They demand the Levite so they can have with him all night long homosexual sex. The man believes in protecting his guest, refuses, and says, "Look, my virgin daughter and his concubine, please let me bring them out, rape them, do with them as you please, but to this man do not do this foolish thing." I have two virgin daughters. I would die for them as you would for yours. I'm horrified at this. So the Levite takes his concubine, like you throw out a piece of meat to a bunch of rabid dogs, and all night long they rape her. I think we have a hint there as to why she might have left him. That then sets in motion a chain of events that almost destroys Israel. They rape her through the night, and she crawls half dead to the door. In the morning, the Levite finds her, and without a flicker of emotion or concern, puts her on his donkey and takes her home. I think she's dead. I hope so. I was talking to a doctor who works in the emergency ward of a hospital, who assured me that if someone had undergone that kind of physical trauma and emotional trauma all night long with no help, they'd certainly be dead by dawn. So she's certain the girl is dead. I hope so. He takes her back and then doesn't even give her a burial. He chops her up into 12 pieces, sends each piece out to a tribe in Israel. And we're told at the end of the chapter that nothing like this has ever happened or has been seen since the day Israel came out of the land of Egypt to this day. That now sparks a national crisis. All the tribes of Israel demand Benjamin hands over these worthless fellows. They refuse. And so civil war breaks out. Israel is again at war. But this time the enemy is one of their own. And the victory will come at a very high cost for Israel. If you go back to chapter 1 of Judges, when they invade the land, we read these opening words. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, "Who of us is to go up first to fight against the Canaanites?" The Lord answered, "Judah shall go up." Now they ask the same question. 20 verse 18. Who is to fight for us against, not the Canaanites, against the Benjamites? And God gives the same answer. Judah shall go first. Now your enemy is not without, but within. All up, Israel lose 40,000 men in the battle. And Benjamin finally is slaughtered. men, women, animals slaughtered. Only 600 men survive. But the abuse of women has only just begun. With 600 men alone, this tribe faces extinction within a few years. Hence the end of Israel as 12 tribes. These men must have wives. But the tribes had vowed not to give one of their sons to a Benjamite. But there was a loophole in the contract. There was a city called Jabesh-Gilead that didn't answer the call to fight the Benjamites. They stayed neutral. So the nation decides to attack Jabesh-Gilead, which is, you remember, another Jewish town. They kill all the men, all the women who aren't married, and take their virgin daughters and give them to, there are 400 of them, give them to the Benjamites. That's no different, I think, from Boko Haram that took some years ago 276 schoolgirls and abducted them and announced, "We have married them off. They are in their marital homes." There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's 400. That leaves 200 still without wives. Now, they don't bother praying or seeking the Lord's guidance. Every year in Shiloh, there's a festival to the Lord. And girls come out and dance before the Lord in praise and worship. And while they're dancing, these 200 men hiding behind bushes race out, grab a girl who's worshipping God, and takes her home and forces marriage upon her. These awful chapters begin with a man throwing his woman out to a pack of dogs. They end with a pack of dogs entering the Israelite camp and seizing women as they dance before the Lord. There's no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And that's where the book ends. Again, let me say three things by way of application. Of course, this book isn't written to address issues of domestic violence in the world or the church. There are bigger issues around God and his people. But I think it does address implicitly these moral questions. We are, I think, appalled by what we read in these chapters about the treatment of women. But the mistake we can make, I think, is we can read these chapters and circumvent the church. I heard a while ago a sermon on these chapters, and it began with these words. What's happening in our modern world? No. These words aren't about our modern world. He's describing here Canaan or Philistia or Moab. This is describing the people of Israel. What's happening in our modern church? That's the issue here. The church. One of the great distinctives of the church has been largely its treatment of women, positively. I read a book a while ago, a very good book by a guy called Rodney Stark, called The Rise of Christianity. Why the church grew so quickly in the first 300 years. And one reason was its appeal to women. In the Roman Empire back then, there were more men than women, because women were killed at childbirth. Men wanted sons. So when a girl was born, they left them to die, exposed them. Even large families had no more than one daughter. But Christians didn't. They didn't practice infanticide or abortion. Women died in abortion. Christians kept them alive. Christians cared for the poor and poor women. They found a home in North Africa in a town called Sirte in 303 AD. They found their clothes put aside for the needy. They found 16 men's tunics, 82 women's tunics. They cared for women. Women rose to positions of leadership in the church, in the ancient world, not in the world, in the church. We've been known by and large historically for our care for women. That's why some recent reports on domestic violence in the church are so disturbing. A woman called Isabella Young spoke of her domestic abuse by her Christian husband. She received 100 emails of women in the same situation. Her husband is a Bible study leader. One time he dragged her by the hair upstairs because she spent too long on the phone talking to her mother. Another woman married to a pastor who demanded of her that in the bedroom he fulfill all his sexual fantasies. Another woman was driving with her husband who was abusive, had outbursts of anger. At one point he stopped the car, undid her seatbelt and shoved her out of the car. His line was again and again, "It's my job to get you to submit. It's my job to clip your wings." She replied rightly, "No, it's my job to choose to submit. It's your job to love me." Judges doesn't just turn the spotlight on the world, but on the church. I spoke on this topic a couple of years ago in Singapore, and the pastor said to me, "Did you see the man to your right during your talk looking very angry? He's abusing his wife." Our churches in Wagga Wagga, Albury, Barranduda must be safe places for women. Pastors, treat the women with respect, carefully. No inappropriate words or touching. Husbands, brothers, boyfriends, treat them like they are the daughters of God. May it never be found amongst our churches here. May there be a safe place for women. We need to be at the forefront in our society of respecting women. 1 Peter 3 says, "Husbands, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker vessel and as co-heirs with you of the gracious gift of life." I've got two daughters. I long for them to say, "Dad, I want to marry a man just like you." That's the first thing. The second is, there was no king in Israel. They all did what was right in their own eyes. It's true anywhere. It's true in the home, in the classroom, in the office, in the government. When there's no king, there's chaos. I used to be a high school teacher at Liverpool Boys High School. I had fairly good classroom control, but I was nothing like Mr. Whitby. If he were playing tonight for the Wallabies, we'd beat the All Blacks. He had no problem with classroom control. I was teaching one time in a classroom, in classroom C. Greg was in classroom A, and in classroom B, in the middle, was Miss Gilligan. Now, Irene Gilligan would have made a wonderful librarian. But as a teacher at a boys' high school in Sydney, she was, like every day, a lamb led to the slaughter. And that day in the class, in her class, there was no queen in Israel. They did what was right in their own eyes. It was chaos, just chaos. And the walls were thin and I couldn't teach. So Greg came and knocked on my door. He said, "Mike, this is hopeless. I can't even think, let alone teach. Here's what we'll do. You go in there and tell Irene there's a phone call for her in the office. She'll go out, I'll pop in, I'll have a word to the boys." Greg walked in, had a word to the boys, and there was quiet. Because at last there was a king in the classroom. When there's no king, there's chaos. We need a king. And we have a king, King Jesus, who rules by his word. When he doesn't, there's chaos. A friend of mine, a pastor of a church in Sydney, he told me when he first went to the church, in the first few weeks, two young men wrote to him and told him that since we've joined your church, we've become alcoholics. He went to a Bible study of young people, lots of alcohol, lots of fellowship, and 10 minutes of Bible study. When our Lord stops ruling by his word, there's chaos. I received a while ago, again, I was in Singapore at a conference, I spoke there, and a while later, a man who I don't recall meeting wrote me an email. After this, and he said this: God spoke to me through the talks that my priorities have not been totally aligned with his, and indeed my spiritual life had stagnated since I was an enthusiastic new convert in 2003. I remember at that time I had naively told my bosses in my first few months at work that all that I wanted to do with my life was to serve God, and that career was not a big priority. That enthusiasm soon got lost and choked by the weeds of ambition and worldliness as I pursued a bigger salary and a job with better prospects. To that end, I wound up working in the finance industry in the last 2 years of my working life, through which I've grown in materialism, greed, and ungodliness. God has been merciful to me to give me a wake-up call. The first practical step that I've taken is to resign my finance job. For personally, I know it has been a hindrance to my spiritual growth. I'm currently serving notice and will leave my current company on September the 4th. I'm looking for another job in public service with more altruistic objectives. And I'm quite sure I won't be returning to the finance industry. I'm also in the process of signing up to join to volunteer for the Salvation Army in tutoring disadvantaged children. I signed up for a mission conference in September and hope to embark on my first mission trip soon. Another step I plan to take is to take up a diploma in theology and grow in the Word. From compromise to Christ-likeness. From serving self to serving others. From following his own desires to following King Jesus and living under his rule. When we proclaim King Jesus by his word, there's order and peace and godliness. And when we don't, there's moral and spiritual anarchy. Well, these are the last chapters and my last words, and they're hard words to end on. The last words of Judges are, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. But thank God, they're not the last words of the Bible. I don't know, maybe God has spoken to you today through the talks about failure, about compromise, about how you treat the weaker vessel. And the last word to you today and to me is not judgment. That's not God's last word. It's always grace. God's last word, that's the last word of the Bible. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. That's grace. If he forgave Israel, how much more will he forgive you and me who trust his son? If he restored Israel, how much more will he restore you and me who are his adopted sons? You don't read this book and look back on your life with regrets. You read this book and look forward to the future with joy and hope. You are his sons. And God has great plans for you and me for the future. For there is a king in Albury Presby Church and Wagga Presby and Barranduda Community Church. There is a king in our church. And his name is Jesus. And those who live under his kingship do what is right in his eyes. And we'll hear one day from him the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Let me pray.